We're going to call the meeting to order this morning of the House Agriculture Policy Committee at the stroke of 10:15. We don't have a quorum here quite yet, but we're going to get going. A lot of items on the agenda. And just for your benefit, a couple of the bills we're going to be hearing today will not be voted on here. They are informational only. They relate to a couple of buffer bills. Representative Backer has one to vote on, one for information. And we've also asked Representative Torkelson to come in today and to go over the new language of his buffer bill, which was heard for the first time in the Environment Committee yesterday. But again, that also is an informational hearing only today in the Policy Committee. Again, welcome this morning on this day before we break for Easter and Passover recess. It's good to be here. Snow is melting quickly, we hope, and the spring is just around the corner. First bill up today is House File 3186, Representative Swazinski, and we do not have a quorum yet, I believe. We're short one. So we'll begin and call Representative Swazinski up here. Good morning. And have you start going over your bill, and then when we have a quorum, we'll stop and officially move your bill.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, Chairman, members. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the Ag Committee today. Before we have House File 8136. House File 8136 came...
Check 3186.
Oh, 31. Sorry.
Okay. We don't have quite that many bills yet.
Yeah, here. Sorry about that. 3186 came to me because in my district in the small town of Porter, Minnesota, we had a elevator go bankrupt. And as many of you guys know, when there's a bankruptcy in a small town, one of the few employers that you have, it not only rocks the local economy of the town, but it also affects the folks that are in partnership with that business. And a lot of those partners are ag producers, a lot of farmers, grain farmers, animal agricultural types. And really, this bill is looking to not only address the issues in Porter, but for potential issues that may happen across the state. I'll just kind of flip through and kind of go over a little bit over some of the changes that we have looking at doing in statute.
Representative, just let's hold on a second. We had Representative Marquardt step in, so he is officially on the roster. So I'll officially call the meeting to order. And I will move your bill, Representative. The bill number is 3186 to be referred to the Committee of Civil Law and Data Practices. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And so just moving in at the page from on page 2.5 to 2.11, we changed some of the bonding amounts. So essentially what this portion in a line of business when you're an elevator, you're required to purchase a certain amount of bonding. Generally, it's reflected on the amount of business that you're doing, and so we changed some of those amounts to increase them, and that would affect mostly cash sales. So those bond accounts that are in these number range, so if you have a check that's potentially bounced, so between the time of a grain sale, going to the elevator, picking up a check, taking it to the bank, and it bounces, these funds can help reimburse producers for some of that potential lost revenue. Moving down into the second page, I'm just going to kind of go over it, is where 3.3 is where the beginning of the indemnity account occurred. And really looking at what other states have done, I, with research, looked at the state of North Dakota primarily. They have set up an indemnity account funded in a different way. Their bill takes a small percentage of each bushel of grain sold in the state of North Dakota to build the account up until it reaches the point of $6 million. At that point, then that special assessment goes away on each bushel. We take the view of looking at collecting a portion of the grain bin sales. So on average, I think the fiscal report kind of maybe unofficial report came in, looks at it, collects about $3.5 million per year. throughout the state for grain bin sales, the sales tax. And then after 3 years, after the account's been filled to $6 million, I think it's end of June of 2018, that sales tax is eliminated. And so that's been a big portion of, I know that's been a goal of agriculture, to eliminate that sales tax on a vital part of not only ag but agribusiness, that sales tax on a piece of that. And you can move down to 3.24. We looked at some of the, in the breach of contract, we moved some of those limitations to $650,000 or up to 80% of the valuation of those contracts. And the idea was that we had initially put $1 million there, but really there's some general fear within the industry allowing that number to be too high because essentially it would be used as a limitation of risk for producers rather than just a protection. And so that's why we moved it down to $650,000. Moving on, and we go into the 4.11 on the fourth page. We have the creation of a grain bin gross receipts tax. And the that occurred because the question came up on if we eliminate the sales tax of grain bins after the completion of the fulfillment of the $6 million into the grain addendum account, what would we use if there's a future catastrophe where we have maybe a larger entity go out of business? And so with the elimination of the sales tax, we felt that was still maybe a decent area for the bill or area of funding. So we looked at other areas of law and found that gross receipts tax may fill that button. And because we're eliminating the sales tax, we felt maybe a 2% gross receipts tax would also lead to a large decrease in the cost, but also a limitation, kind of a window opening and closing until the account gets up to from $2 million, where it would get kicked on to back to that $6 million point for future issues that may arise. With that, I also have a few folks that would like to speak on behalf of the bill.
Representative, did you have an amendment that you'd like to move as well?
I don't have the amendment on me.
I happen to have it here.
Would you want to move it, sir?
I would move the A1 amendment, and if you would care to explain what the amendment does, it adds a couple of words.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That'd be an author's amendment, and I'd appreciate your support.
Okay. So the A1 amendment, supported by the author. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment is approved. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I've got three producers that have been affected by the closure or the bankruptcy in Porter, Minnesota. Chris Wallum, Dwayne Monkey, and Leon Vanderstein. Chris, if you want to introduce yourself. And
good morning, sir. Identify yourself and then proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Chair members. My name is Chris Wallum. I am from Porter, Minnesota. I am a former deliverer of grain to the Porter Elevator. My family has done business with them since their family opened the elevator. And for years and years and years, we had a strong trust with them and didn't have concerns. What happened was, though, is in my case, I was doing tax planning for the year, and after doing my tax planning, I needed to take more income to make my taxes in line to where I want them to be. I called to have a check issued. I got the check, picked up the check on Monday. I had an appointment to go to my bank on Wednesday. So my bank is not in the same, we don't have a bank in our small town of Porter. So I held the check until Wednesday until I went to the bank. I did my business at the bank, went home. On Thursday, I found out the elevator had closed its doors. On Friday, I got a call back from the bank saying my check was no good. So at that point, I realized that there's a point in time when you sell your product as a farmer where you have literally no protection. You become an unsecured creditor as soon as you sell that grain or livestock until that check is made good by your bank. So that's a category I fell into. I was an unsecured creditor, and now at this point, the only thing I have to fall back on is the bond. And the current bond required for an elevator doing between $14 and $24 million of business is only $125,000. And between the three individuals that are here today, with that $125,000 bond, that will return approximately 10 cents on the dollar to the money that we're short. going forward, the rural economy doesn't look good. Obviously, you guys have heard that over and over again. And things like this will potentially put some farmers out of business. For me, it basically meant begging my lender to make sure that I can operate for one more year until things get straightened out to see where things come through on the bankruptcy. So I guess I'm very appreciative of Representative Swazinski for his willingness to help the rural communities with this type of protection against these situations that could come again in the future. Because like I said, the rural economy is looking a little bleak, and there's no saying that something like this couldn't happen again. So it would be nice to have that type of protection to know that in that little window of when you sell something to when you get that money into your account, that if something like this were to happen, that there may be something to help protect you. So I guess with that, I appreciate Chris and his efforts, and I appreciate your consideration on this bill.
Any questions from members of the committee? Mr. Wallum, thank you. I can sympathize with the feeling it must have been to get that phone call and say that check was not good. Thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you.
You had somebody else, Representative?
We have Leon Vanderstein, also would like to come before the committee.
Good morning, and let's hear your name again, the Dutch name, and then proceed, sir.
Okay. Thank you, sir. My name's Leon Vanderstein, and I've done business in Porter all my life. And December 9th, I went to the elevator in the morning at 8 o'clock, and I sold my grain. And I told the owner there that I would be back in a couple hours after chores to pick up my check, which I did. I came back, and I picked up my check, and I went right to the bank and cashed a check. And the next day, the elevator closed, and I was out over $100,000. And that's my story. I sold the grain at 8 o'clock in the morning. The check was in the bank at 11 o'clock. And I got nothing out of it. So, and I got no protection except the bonding bill, and which amounts to probably by the time everybody's included, will be less than 10 cents on the dollar. So that's my story.
Thank you. That one's tough to hear. They're all tough to hear, but just in a matter of hours. And your third testifier?
Yeah, I think he's going to sit it out. But, Mr. Chair, that was Mr. Vanderstein's first visit. This is his first visit to the Capitol since he was in the sixth grade.
So. Well, welcome back. Wish it were under much better circumstances. Again, questions, Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to clarify. What we're talking about today does not help these farmers that we're talking about going forward, or is there any way we can help these guys?
Well, Mr.
Representative Swazinski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Nornes, we do have the bill that we have funded does a prompt payment of $2.5 million into that $6 million indemnity account, and because of our fiscal year and the way we're working on it, we're making any instances that may have occurred within this by 2015 would be eligible.
Okay, good.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Swazinski, the prompt payment would come from where?
Be the general fund.
Swazinski?
Mr. Chair, the general fund.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are very tough stories mm-hmm. to hear, and very heartbreaking, and I think certainly people who have gone through this would be, boy, you could be at the end of your rope pretty quickly. So I can appreciate the stories, and thank you for sharing. I guess I'm a bit concerned about the idea of going backwards, so that sounds like something that I usually hear in committee. We can never go backwards. You know, there's going to be litigation or there's going to be something. And so going backwards to try to fix something retroactively is not typically done. It's like from this point forward, and people that have suffered a consequence in the past, we feel their pain, but we can't make them whole. And so I'm just, I guess I'm a bit, as much as I'd like to be able to say, you know, here's the magic wand and we can make this happen, I'd just like a response on that, I guess. How is this different from what we often hear and how we usually operate?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Poppe. You know, this is the way we have the bill drafted. And I would say it's probably not much different than what we've heard before. But the fact that we're having the conversation, I think, is important. And we'll, I'm working to, willing to work with this committee, but also the committee is moving forward, that we stay within the structural bounds of the legislature and what we've done in past practices.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know, this is obviously a single incident that's impacting a lot of people for a significant amount of dollars. Are there others in the recent past or in the 5 years past or 10 years past that you are aware of something like this happening?
Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe. I don't have copies for the committee, but there was also another smaller event, I believe in the city of Ormsby, that happened within the 2015. And then prior to that, there was a Heartland Seed in 2014, Bowling Feed and Grain in 2014, Anderson Seed in 2012, Green Meadow Bean in 2012, Winslow Farm Elevator in 2011, Green Meadow Bean 2011, Northland Seed in 2011, Bach Co-op Creamery in 2011, Northland Organic in 2011, and Minnesota Grain in 2011.
Representative, do you have any, I appreciate that that list of other occurrences. Do you have any quick history of what happened in some of those, how the farmers came out in those cases?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. You know, and that seems like a long list, but when you look at the numbers, they're probably not exactly large. And I think that's probably the big, you know, would be, you know, in a decent beef that would be folks would have with this bill, is that oftentimes the organizations and the entities that we're dealing with are not the large entities, are not the large grain buyers, are not the large cooperatives. They're oftentimes a one or a two-man shop. And I think that is probably one of the biggest gaps that we have when I'm pursuing this bill, is that when you're looking at how the bill would be funded and who it would affect, you know, who's going to really pay for it and who's going to receive the benefit. And I can tell you, you know, of those, you know, 10 that I listed off, you know, valid claims range from, you know, this would be on the bonding side, you know, from, you know, 700,000, and a majority of those would be in that 10 to 15, 20, $100,000 range, and a couple, you know, another one over 450,000. And then the percent covered would kind of varies between 100%, 19%, 70%, 24%. So they're definitely on the smaller side, and I think, and it's a valid claim by a lot of the stakeholders that are concerned with how this bill and who it would help, and but who would fund it as well. So,
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned a number of listed quite a number. Are they all grain operators? Is it the same? Would they be the same as what you're defining here in the bill?
Representative Poppe. They would all be considered grain buyers, I believe. And so that would be, an elevator would be considered a grain buyer purchaser. So whether it be just the size changes.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then when you mentioned, I'm just learning all this, so I appreciate learning about it. But so when you said some get 100%, some get 19%, 70%, how was that it was different like that?
Representative.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, you know, maybe the department could come up here. They're the ones that gave me the list. You know, it's my understanding, and I could maybe have folks make a copy of this sheet that I have before me. I apologize for not providing that to the committee. It's my estimate. So just take, for example, 2011, we had Minnesota Grain. They had a total of $691,000 of valid claims. So what a valid claim is, Representative Poppe, or Chairman Anderson, Representative Poppe, mm-hmm. is the instance that the gentleman in the past, they had so much sold that wasn't potentially, that bounce check. And so the amount paid out would be $50,000. So in that instance, if you look back onto our the portion of the bill in the second page, so it was likely that Minnesota Grain on page 2.24 fell within that window of $3 million of business to $6 million in business. Okay, and so their bond amount would have been at that period of time $50,000. And so when looking at Minnesota Grain, they had valid claims of $691,000. Their total paid out was $50,000. So that was that bond portion. And that covered approximately 7.24% of, so the bond claim, the separation of bond claim to the $50,000.
We're kind of getting in the weeds here, but those are good numbers to know. And I realize the case that's kind of in the forefront today is an ongoing case. Mm-hmm. Can you give us any idea of the size of the claims? Is that public knowledge, or is that still in the courts?
Mr. Chair, I am not positive. I mean, I know the numbers, and I'm not sure how positive or public some of that those numbers are at.
Okay.
You know,
you
might
say fairly large.
Yeah. You know, I believe the potential bond dollars that would have been subject to the bond portion, I think, would be under $1 million. You know, maybe $800,000, and then the and that's you still have to. So the process works. So if that occurs, and you have to essentially apply to the department or apply to the bond to say, you know, I had a check of $100,000, I would like to put a claim against the bond amount. Okay, and so I think the bond amount, the dollars that they felt were eligible to request a claim against the bond was in that range. And then on the flip side, from an addendi account, so those folks that had future contracts or delayed payment, so that operates, you know, you essentially, when you sign into that contract for members of the committee, when you have grain, you deliver it, so in November, or October, November, whenever you're having your harvest season, you're taking your grain, delivering it to the entity in which you want to do business with for storage or for sale, and you may take payment at that moment. You can have a cash check written to you. You can say, I sell it now, but I don't want to take the check till January. That would be considered a delayed payment contract. And so essentially that $6 million indemnity would cover you if in that period of time when you've sold on contract your property, which would be the grain, but not received payment, and between that period of time a bankruptcy occurs, you've essentially signed that grain over. And so now the way that, you know, through the bank, you know, the bankers have first rights. So they usually have an operation loan, which is, you know, that loan is probably predicated on maybe grain, or I don't know how the collateral operation works, but then you also have the loan on the physical property. So those banks, in a first, when a bankruptcy occurs, have first rights towards the property that are on the premises. And so depending on what happened between the time of the sale, of or the way the contract was written and that final payment was made or whatever it was made, if that grain is gone, then you sign your grain over, and where you, it depends on how the final sale, because the auction for this facility is happening on March 31st. So on the 31st of March, the proceeds and the amount of grain has been calculated by the USDA, or the Department of Agriculture, so how many bushels of corn, how many bushels of beans that were on the premises, and they've looked at all the contracts, all the deliveries, so all the pieces of paper that you get, the stubs, and they're dividing that out to say, well, you know, Johnny over here had 100,000 bushels, this guy over here had 15,000 bushels, you know, we probably have 80% of that or 20% of that. Then they'll sell it all. They'll do the process. They're going to be selling the semis off, selling the land off. They'll be, you know, filling back some of the loans that may be against that to the bankers, and then what's left over potentially may be given back to those folks with long-term contracts.
A couple more questions. Chair Hamilton.
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Swazinski, on Section 3, these original bond amounts, do you recall when they were originally set? How long has it been since this has been addressed? That'd be my first question.
Representative or anybody from the Department of Ag?
Mr. Chair, I phoned a friend in 2004.
2004, thank you. And then my other question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Chairman.
And Representative Swazinski, is there any opposition? Where do the commodity groups, the ag groups, where do they sit on this?
Representative?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is some definite concerns, and I spoke to a bit of that. Some of the commodity groups are just concerned about the idea of an indemnity account and the rarity of its use, the costs on the consumers that may or may not participate, because when I talked about who would likely to use the indemnity account and the higher bonds and need them are the smaller operators, and the larger operators, and in fairness, wouldn't probably be in need of this as much as others. Just because of financial stability, when you're dealing with a one-family business operation or dealing with a couple of creditors versus a multi-state, multi-region business, you know, it is a different story. And I think that's where a lot of that stems from, and it's a valid claim. So.
Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, and I was just wondering, are we going to hear from any of them today?
We are going to hear from a couple other testifiers. Representative Nornes.
Garth Brooks just announced the third concert in Fargo. It's my bulletin I just got.
You can get us some tickets.
I can't get tickets. Mr. Chair and Representative, you mentioned earlier that there's clouds hanging over agriculture for the future, the way it looks. Is the potential for other situations like this to occur because of that? And is there any negative, or what's the impact on the elevators and the grain buyers? Is there additional cost that they'll be bearing?
Representative Swazinski.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Anderson and Representative Nornes. You know, obviously if I had a crystal ball, I would have probably sold my grain while harvest was going on, but I did not do that either. And you know, if you look at commodity prices and you look at the general outlooks and you talk to some of the folks within the ag community, you know, you look at loan amounts and you look at cash flows, I think, you know, we're still fairly healthy from an ag perspective. But, you know, that only can last so long. Cash reserves in any business will get consumed if you're selling your product as a loss, and that's the issue that we're having. I'd say the primary concern when it comes to cost would be when we increase the bond amounts. So if you're looking at moving from $50,000 to $300,000, there is probably a little bit of an increase for the cost of business to purchase those bonds. But any increase in cost, I think, would be far outweighed by the eventual elimination of the sales tax of the future expansions when grain bins would be sold or eliminated.
Okay, thanks. We have on the list to testify Mr. Zelenka. Next testifier up, as he works his way down, is Mr. Zelenka to comment on the bill. Had a question first, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think, sorry to interrupt the testimony here, but I have a question about the bond. I guess I see that you are also in Subdivision 4 looking at increasing the bond amounts then. So that would be a little bit more helpful, obviously, mm-hmm. than it's going to be cents on the dollar mm-hmm. for the most part, but that that seems like something that would be a good first step, at least, to do that into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
comment, Representative?
Mr. Chair Anderson and Representative Poppy, you know, and I think that is that is a key to a portion of this. And, you know, you're trying to look at a window in time. And really, that's what this is to affect. This isn't looking, you know, if you look at those numbers, it's $6 million to $12 million. That seems like a big amount of money. But you're also insuring on a window of time from when that check is cut to when financial insolvency is actually realized, because that business will cease to exist. Because the USDA comes down, the Department of Revenue shuts the business down essentially so that no checks are being written, you know, no grain is being moved within and out of the entity. And so that's really what that looks at. But, you know, the bond, you know, from an internal standpoint, What it does is allow for some, just the sale of the bond from the department standpoint allows for some financial review of the entity. So in order for you to buy that bond, you need to show some worthiness to have ability to get that bond. And so it's a little bit about the money that the bond actually holds, but it's also about the review that the acquisition of the bond will allow. And so it's kind of a combination of both. And
Representative Johnson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Swazinski, you just mentioned in your last comments prior to those that about the elimination of the sales tax and the grain bins. What's the long-term cost of that?
Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we could bring Pat Dalton up, but I can maybe speak to it. I think we have some unofficial cost estimates. It's on average $3.5 million are brought into the state coffers per year for the grain bin sales tax, and it's estimated, so it'd be $3.5 million. There was a prior bill that was moved with the idea of this, I think in 2012, that had a fiscal cost of $4.5 million. And so we got kind of a preliminary report back that may have dropped down to $3.5 million. And then the cost of the gross receipts tax would bring approximately about $1 million a year.
But again, just to clarify, that would be, under this legislation, a permanent loss to the general fund, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
And that would, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, so that would actually, so it would be two and a half to 2018, June 29th, and then after that, it would blink off. So it would be, you know, approximately $2.5 million loss to the general fund because of the bill.
Okay. Next testifier, identify yourself and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Zolenka. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We represent the grain elevator and feed mill industry here in the state of Minnesota. Our association has been around for 109 years representing this industry. And the breakdown, basically, of our membership, or of the industry, I should say, you have approximately 450 locations in the state of Minnesota. About 250 of those locations are owned or operated by cooperatives, and another 200 are owned and operated by non-cooperatives, privates. These are mom and pops, Cargill, and so on. To give you just a rough idea. Before I get into my testimony, I'd like to address the question that came up earlier about the 10 firms that were listed by the state in terms of bond claims in the past. I'd like to point out that only two of those were grain elevators, and each of those paid out 100%. So they had total payout to the farmers. The rest of those, Minnesota Grain, which was referenced, not a grain elevator. It's a grain buyer, but not a grain elevator. Northland Organic was a non-GMO processor and handler. Northland Seed Company, Green Meadow Bean, Edible Beans. Green Meadow Bean, again, Edible Beans. Anderson Seed, non-GMO grains and edible beans. Heartland Seed Company, they paid out 100% as well. So I just wanted to clarify. When we talk about the rarity in our industry, it still is a rarity in our industry to encounter these kinds of situations. So while we sympathize certainly with the anguish felt by these producers who've done business with Porter, found themselves potentially not getting paid under the deferred payment contracts, this bankruptcy situation is rare. And for that fact alone, and for the circumstances surrounding this, the unique circumstances surrounding this situation, we are not in support of this legislation. We feel that an indemnity fund encourages risky behavior when you have nothing to lose, and when you're doing business with a marginal player, if you will, that you can fall back on this fund to recover your loss. An indemnity fund, in essence, is asking good operators to provide bailout program for marginal operators, and we don't feel that's fair. The $650,000 payment limit that came down from $1 million is still high in our estimation. Encourages, in our estimation, in our opinion, risky behavior on both buyers and the sellers. Creating and maintaining an indemnity fund will certainly create ongoing costs for the acquiring the funds, the administration of the funds, which would go on for in perpetuity. These costs would ultimately land at the foot of the producers, who are essentially going to be paying for any costs related to this type of a program. Once again, producers could avoid these costs and the risks by exercising basic due diligence in regards to whom they essentially are lending their money to through a deferred payment contract. Deferred payment contracts are pretty common. It's a nice tool that producers use to manage their tax liabilities. And as such, they should, in our opinion, be willing to carry some of that risk. Even money in the bank is not fully insured by FDIC, as an example. So why should we be looking at something that's going to provide this type of protection over and above what we think is fair? Today's farmers are generally very astute business people, and as such, they should understand the basic business practices and recognize when doing business with a firm that demonstrates what you might call unusual behavior. My co-op elevator members tell me how transparent they are with their patrons, and in itself should provide level of confidence for farmers doing business with them. They hold annual meetings, they have financials that are readily available to all patrons. They also have a board of directors that's made up of patrons that meet regularly, are reviewing financial statements, and usually these financial statements are prepared by outside CPA firms, so that you have, it's not an internal document being prepared by the company themselves. The bond increases was talked about being proposed will certainly add bond premium to grain buyers. Could be as high as an additional $3,000 increase in premium to a grain buyer. That would, if you're looking at the grain buyer increase, the maximum bond there would be $600,000, as was suggested. That would be approximately a $4,500 premium for that. Plus, grain elevators who store grain would have a storage bond, and that premium on that bond varies, but it's around $4,000 to $5,000 premium as well. So you're looking at a substantial jump in premium that would and could force bond underwriters to take a closer look at these firms, because they're looking at your debt net worth, working capital, debt to worth ratio, manager experience, those kinds of things, and maybe that's the intent, to have these higher bonds to weed out those people that maybe don't have the financial strength to support these bonds. But be that as it may, it does have an impact and will be felt by the industry. We had just a few recommendations we'd like to make in lieu of pursuing an indemnity fund. First one is insurance. Yes, insurance is available. It's available to cover deferred payment contracts. We sell it through our in-house agency. CHS makes it available, and other grain elevators specifically market this product. And in fact, in the region impacted by this bankruptcy, it's available by some elevators in that region as well. What we're suggesting there is that perhaps the state, that's the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, could require grain buyers to offer the insurance at the time these contracts are being made available, and then have the farmers sign a form that indicates that they were offered this insurance and declined the coverage. Secondly, this would be in addition to current state law, which requires all contracts, and this is about 25 years old, I think, this language, but current state law requires all contracts to carry language above where the farmer signs the contract that clearly states in 10 font, I think it is, this contract constitutes a voluntary extension of credit. This contract is not covered by any grain buyer bond. Very clearly stated on the contract, so the farmer should know when they're selling their grain under a DP contract that there is no bond coverage covering that transaction. Speaking of bonding, bonding is never meant, has never been meant to be insurance against loss. Bonding is simply a screening process that's conducted by an independent third party that looks at the items I mentioned, net worth, working capital, and so on. But looking at the financial strength of an entity, and then and only then can that grain buyer be licensed. Without a bond, you cannot get a license. If everybody does their job correctly, there should be no bond claims. Yes, there's some money set aside just in case there's a loss. But again, bonding is not, never was intended to be insurance. And as such, again, it's a screening mechanism. It's worked pretty well over the last 80, 90 years we've had bond requirements here in the state of Minnesota. Another state law, current law, states clearly A grain buyer purchasing grain by voluntary extension of credit contracts shall at all times maintain grain, rights in grain, or proceeds from the sale of grain totaling 90% of the grain buyer's obligation for grain purchase by voluntary extension of credit contracts. So in our opinion, a better option would be to have to the indemnity fund would be to have the Department of Agriculture increase its enforcement of the existing law through additional and more thorough on-site examinations of all grain buyers. Lastly, under current law, as was referenced in the legislation under Chapter 223, an alternative to bonding currently is available to potential grain buyers. This part of the law governing buying and storing of grain allows an irrevocable letter of credit or cash or other financial instruments to be deposited with the commissioner in lieu of a bond. The amount would be the same as what the bond would be required, but this would be in lieu of a bond. What's missing there is that critical component that the bond plays, that is, an independent third party actually reviewing the financial statements and the financial strength of this particular applicant. Our suggestion would be to eliminate that loophole and only require bonding and not allow anything other than bonding for people to enter into the grain buying business. Again, we certainly have sympathized with the farmers that were caught up in this unfortunate bankruptcy. I don't understand the situation that clearly down there. It sounded like about 80% of the outstanding deferred payment contracts were with two brothers. Last I heard, there was 9 claims made under the grain buyer bond, and 3 were valid claims, and it only amounted to $87,000 at that time. I suspect the gentlemen that spoke earlier have filed their claims and are pending with the Department of Agriculture, and if they haven't, I would certainly encourage them to do so. Again, it's an unfortunate situation, but our industry is strong. I think with these recommendations that we made, that I think under current situation, I think the department could play a stronger role and forego the unnecessary, in our opinion, and costly venture into an indemnity fund. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Zelenka. I still think that you bring up very, very valid concerns, but I think it still is good. A good thing that we are looking at this today, hearing about it from the agriculture policy side, and the bill would have other stops along the way where you could work on it, Representative Swedzinski, and we feel that the need is there, but we want to feel that we feel that some more work is necessary, and to do that, we'd like to hear what others have to say as well. Anybody else in the audience to testify on the bill? Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and I am working with the Minnesota Soybean Growers on this particular issue. Last week, we had a teleconference with a number of soybean growers on this issue. And first of all, I'd like to identify for you that this is a very complicated issue, and there are many, many sides to it, because we had a half a dozen farmers that were leaders of our association that were on discussing this issue, and those 6 people, I think, gave about 9 different answers as to what should or shouldn't be done relative to this bill or the subject in general. Let me at least identify a few things. So I want to start off by saying that I'm not exactly, I'm not opposing the bill and I'm not supporting the bill right now. There's still work to be done from our association to try and figure out where they come in on the many different facets of the bill. In general, there was some general support for increasing bonding requirements, but there was also people that had concerns about that. And the reason they had the concerns about that is because they were concerned about how it might affect their opportunity to sell to different size of grain buyers, as an example. The one thing that did come out crystal clear on the entire discussion, however, was the fact that they do not feel farmers, that there is much transparency in this situation. And I know that Mr. Zelenka just indicated that if you read the contracts, you would know about what is involved. But that's a little bit like when you buy a house and you're trying to read all of the papers on the contracts, yes, as businessmen, they should be smart and they should know how to do those things. But generally, most farmers and I had a lot of people call me afterwards that weren't even on the conference call and gave their 2 cents. Most don't seem to understand what risk they're taking. And so one of the suggestions that came out pretty strongly from our group was that they wanted to have greater transparencies in these transactions. That, for instance, the bond is not posted at the elevator to my... I'll defer to Mr. Zelenka if I'm wrong, but I know that we had farmers calling elevators saying, do you have to post bond requirements? And the elevators themselves said they didn't know. And they told them, and when they asked them, well, how much bond do you have at your elevator? Well, I can tell you how much we have, but it's different for every elevator. And, of course, if you look at the statute, you'll see that it is different for every elevator based upon what they do. The discussion came up about then, well, shouldn't we post these things? And we actually had one farmer that also was a grain buyer. He actually didn't like the idea of posting it because he was concerned that it would make him look, well, I only have $150,000 of bond, and Senex Harvest States has much more, and so therefore it's going to make me at a disadvantage in terms of the ability to buy. But bottom line was this. The transparency issue came out pretty clear that people would like to see more transparency so that it was posted at the elevator, how much bond they actually had. I know that to get that information now, I was talking to Mr. Zelenka, and he indicated that, well, you could find that out if you went to the Department of Agriculture. Well, that's not something probably most farmers are doing. And so some transparencies in terms of what is not only the amount, but what is actually covered. Because there was great confusion amongst farmers as to what was covered. Now, it's my understanding that what actually is covered by the bond basically is bouncy checks and stored grain. But it does not cover, and again, I defer to Mr. Zelenka because I respect his knowledge of this, but it does not cover forward pricing as an example. And I think that there were farmers that just, even though they maybe could have read the fine print in the contract, didn't necessarily understand that they were giving extensions of credit to grain elevators at the time. So one of the suggestions I would have along the line here is that perhaps we could increase at least the transparency of these transactions so that farmers are fully aware what risk they are taking when they make certain transactions with grain elevators or grain buyers. Secondly, I think that there is a concern relative to the indemnity portion of the bill, not so much probably about the indemnity, but you know, if we could write everything in this Ag Committee, everybody would be pretty happy because they think you would all understand. But as this bill goes forward to civil law and taxes and a lot of other places, the opportunity for change is there. And there was a great deal of concern that this thing could morph into a different source, other sources of income to pay for the indemnity. And it was brought up in this committee today, a lot of discussion about, well, is it coming out of the general fund and so forth. And what they absolutely do not want to see is a tax on grain in order to pay for the indemnity fund. So kind of state that up front, that and they're concerned about this morphing. And with that, Mr. Chairman, and with you tapping your watch, I will stop.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. I'll have to be more discreet, I guess, from now on. Representative Poppy.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question. Mr. Schoenfeld, regarding insurance, Mr. Zelenka gave an example of perhaps having an opportunity for the farmers to purchase some insurance and then sign off on that if they choose not to or whatever. Any comments about that?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy, that is not something that was discussed with me, and so I have no knowledge of that.
Anybody else who would care to testify for or against the bill? We've given it a pretty good hearing so far. I think we all see the the complexity of the issue here. A lot of different areas coming together, and the attempt by Representative Swazinski to address the issue, I salute him for that. And I think the bill needs some more work, but I think the purpose of our committee here is to hear the agriculture policy issues of it, and you're on very solid ground in what you're trying to do with that. But I think there are other committees that may be better suited to talk about the indemnities and the levels of that and insurance. So I think that we should move along, but not before a comment from Representative Chair Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was basically going to just echo what you had said. Representative Swazinski, thank you for bringing this forward. And you hear the stories, and like Representative Poppy said, you feel for the people that are impacted negatively by this. I also agree, after listening to testimony, there's more work that needs to be done, and I believe we have your commitment that we'll address these concerns as this moves forward. There's going to be a number of stops as well, and so I look forward to working with you on this too.
Any closing comments, Representative Swazinski?
Chair Anderson, I just appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee and allowing especially my folks to be able to travel up to the Capitol sometimes for the second time to tell their story about, you know, how they've been affected, and appreciate your concern and your honest forethought on this bill. I make a commitment to you that we will work with the industry players, work with the folks across the state, and also work with my constituents to come up with something that I think folks can appreciate. So, thank you.
Thank you much. Representative Swazinski renews his motion or I guess it's my motion, to move House File 3186 as amended to be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. And good luck as you begin the journey on the way, Representative Swazinski. Next bill coming up this morning, House File 2365. And it is a fellow policy member, so Representative Backer, would you like to move your own bill? We have three more bills on the agenda, so we need to move expeditiously yet this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. What did you just say, Chair? I'm sorry.
I can't repeat that word.
Oh,
again.
Okay. Go ahead. I move that the House File 2365 be referred to the Committee of Environment and Natural Resource Policy and Finance.
The representative moves that his bill be referred to the Policy of Natural Resources, Environment, and Representative Backer, let's hear about your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and members of Ag Policy, fellow members. This bill is a drainage bill. It does not redefine drainage ditches. What it does a better, more efficient, cost-effective way of determining the cost benefits so a ditch can be maintained. Right now we're spending hundreds and thousands of dollars through this process currently, and we could save the state a lot of money. This bill does not cost anything, it saves. And with that said, I will let Alan Woe give you the details. He is the manager and treasurer at the Watershed Boise Sioux District in 12A. And so I'll turn it over to Mr. Wold.
Good morning, sir. Identify your name and please proceed.
Alan Wold from Wheaton, Minnesota, manager and treasurer of the Boise Sioux Watershed. I would like to put a word picture in your mind. You are in Arden Hills in 1930 and you build a house for $30,000. Now you want to put a new roof on it and siding and windows. You go before the appropriate committee or to get a building permit, and they say it's denied, and you ask why, and they said your original cost of your house was $30,000 and you're spending way too much. But you counter with that my house is valued at $350,000 on the tax rolls, and you are told that that doesn't matter. And people would say, well, that's insanity. And that's what we live under out there. We have ditches that were constructed literally in 1915. At that time, we had the cost-benefit ratio calculated. Enter 2015, there's a request for maintenance on the ditch. We are using modern-day construction funds for the cost, but we still are stuck with 19-15 cost-benefit ratios. And we tell all the ditch, the people that live along the ditch, that they cannot have their ditch maintained unless we go through an expensive review process. Now, there is a difference with the repair of an existing ditch and a new ditch or expansion of one. The Bois de Sioux set up a viewer school, and I attended, so I am a trained viewer. And I'll give you a quick snapshot of what we are told. Pretend this envelope is an existing ditch system. It has defined edges. For our repair, you stay in those defined edges. And you look at the soil, which hasn't changed. You look at the slope of the land, which hasn't changed. The ratios, those who are farthest from the ditch itself pay less because they're benefited less. Those right next to the ditch benefit the most and they pay more. But those ratios have been accepted for 100 years. So when we do the viewing, we take all those things into consideration, but the key of the whole process, we literally go to the courthouse and find out what are present land values, what have sales been, and based on those, we reimburse the farmer or the landowner for the land that's taken away. Because when you have a repair on an existing ditch, there has to be a buffer. And no one argues with that. It's just, it's a long, costly process to come up with the answer that's already at the courthouse. So what this bill does, and I'll read it, is the original bill, it says, cutting down to 114, the drainage authority determines that a drainage bill is in need of repair, which we already do, so that it no longer serves its original purpose and the cost of the repair will not exceed the total benefits determined in the original drainage system proceeding. That's hopelessly out of date. That's why all we do is as determined by updating land values based on the county assessor's most recent estimated market value. We're just trying to streamline it. The ditch we're reviewing now, it will take 6 months, and we've heard situations where the cost of the viewing process alone exceeds construction. And that's it in a nutshell.
Any questions for Mr. Wold or Representative Backer? I have a quick one, Mr. Wold.
Yes.
Drainage law, as you mentioned, is old, relatively, dating back 100 years or so, and we've had this cost-benefit analysis with us since that time. And what you're telling us seems to make so much common sense. Why haven't we moved to this a long time ago, or are there any downsides to doing this?
Chairman Anderson and the committee, it came up at the Bois de Sioux when the buffer bill that was passed last year. I personally felt that all of our ditches are out of compliance and illegal because we've never had the buffer strip. But the truth is we were within the law because our ditches had not been cleaned for 60-70 years. So we didn't have to have this buffer there. And that's why it was never addressed. But we have many ditches come up for request for maintenance, and we already know the answer when the farmers come in. It's no, unless we go through a very expensive, long process. If we can shorten it and cut to the chase, and here's the value of the land at the courthouse, because that's the ultimate question, is how do we reimburse the landowner? The dirt and everything else stays the same. That's why it hasn't come up, because we find out we have 60 ditches that are mostly all out of repair, and we need to do something.
Okay.
Why it has never come up before, and the downsides, I don't really know if there are any.
Okay.
It'll save the state hundreds of millions because other ones can do the same thing.
Okay. And when you mentioned the buffer proposal, which we're going to hear about later on, that brings up the question then, if the watershed were going to reimburse the landowner in some measure for the cost of the land where the buffer is located on, do you have to use, under current law, the older land valuations under current law, or could you use more current numbers?
No, under current law, we have to go through a viewing process to update. the law that we were trying, that we use in our watershed district is decades old. It provides for a viewing process, and when the new land values are in there, then that's the figure we use to reimburse landowners when the buffer is in place. The buffer bill has been around since the 70s. Anytime you have a repair of a ditch, you have to install a buffer. But until they're repaired, they're legal.
Okay, so then, Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the discussion. I like learning about this. Thinking about Representative Poppy earlier, and I know that when there's the reviewing of the ditch, that's an opportunity for citizens to also, at least this is my understanding, to provide some input about what they feel is their benefits from the ditch.
Is that correct? We will have a hearing,
Mr.
when we're all done, and the input will be taken then.
Representative Johnson, we got to keep control here.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. you do well. My question is then: if this were to proceed, would there still be allowances for those inputs?
Yes,
from the neighbors.
Go ahead, Mr. Wold.
Chairman Anderson and Representative Johnson. Yes, the process for review is already in statute. And there is a timeline, there is a preliminary hearing, and then there's a final hearing before we proceed with the clean-out. Nothing changed.
Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. My final question, and I don't know who would have the answer to this, would be, do the assessors have any concerns with this? Do we know?
Representative Anderson and Johnson.
Mr. Wall, go ahead.
One of our viewers that went to school is an assessor, and he's been an assessor for years. He has no trouble with it. It's just that certain ditches that are in his assessment ditches, he cannot view because of conflict of interest. But other than that, he has no trouble with it.
Okay.
And he should know.
Representative Bly had a question.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. If this takes us off of the topic that we're talking about, that's okay. You can let me know that. But I'm wondering, number one, are there other changes that have occurred that cause the ditches to erode or not be performing the way that they should more recently? Is this a recent problem, or is it just, as you said, 70 years of buildup?
Mr. Wold.
Pardon me?
Mr. Wold, go ahead and respond.
It's just the normal sedimentation of 60 to 70 years. There's been nothing new that's exacerbated the problem.
Thank you. Follow up.
Representative Bly?
The reason I'm sort of asking the question is I recently met with a farmer in my district, and he's in a situation where he's kind of at the end of a long ditch. And over the past few years, the ditch is no longer functioning. In fact, the water, which used to flow into some lakes or a series of lakes, now flows the opposite direction. And he has a field that he wanted to use for hay and alfalfa. It's flooded all the time, so he can't use it. Number one, it seems to be something that's more recent, and I'm wondering, I guess, if, you know, maybe the lakes are filling up with sediment, whatever, I don't know, but he is searching for some remedy. He has trouble getting agreement on what he thinks the solution ought to be. But and again, if this is a question you'd rather talk with me offline, that's fine too. But I guess my concern is when you're evaluating the ditch and its need for repair, is there any consideration given to? I guess what I'm thinking of is that if there weren't buffers installed further upstream, and there was increased sediment because of increased rainfall and the kind of rain that we've been having, could that be a way? I'm not sure exactly what to do with that, but could that be a problem or part of the problem that there weren't practices in place that would have helped?
It's possible. I can't speak to your
personal
situation, but where we live, in 60 to 70 years, there's going to be, you know, the sides may slough in or whatever, and we can't avoid that with really any practices that I'm aware of. Riverbanks do the same thing.
Sure.
But this bill simply allows the repair to go through much quickly, quicker by using established courthouse figures. These are not imaginary. They're updated every year. It's just use that figure, and that cuts to the chase is what it does.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Anybody in the audience who would care to testify? If not, closing comments, Representative Backer.
Chair Anderson and committee members, just a practical bill. Again, it doesn't cost any money, but it saves a lot of money, and it's a good environmental bill because if we're not having the water flow like it was intended to be, that runs into problems, not just with egg production, but when we have a lot of spring runoff that we see out at the Red River Valley area and so forth.
So you renew your motion that
House File
2365?
Yes, I renew my motion that House File 2365 be referred to the Committee of Environmental and Natural Resource Policy and Finance.
All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed, same sign. Motion carries, and the bill is approved. Representative Backer, you have another bill on the agenda.
Yeah, House File 3159. What this bill does, and we're having an informational meeting on this today to really educate the importance of this bill. What it does is it, we have a lot of concern, and you have some package maps in your district and in your package, and Mr. Wool will go through it. But with the definition of public waters, number 9 and number 11, we have a lot of concerns on how that could really take a lot of ag land out of production.
Let's just stop for a second there. When you say number 9 and 11, explain what you mean by that.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're public waters, and I actually what I'll do is it's in your package, but I will defer that to Mr. Wall, and I'll let him do that because he does that more gracefully than I do.
Yeah, it's a definition of public waters. There's a number of definitions, so go ahead and explain that.
Okay, Alan Wold from Weed, Minnesota. Chairman Anderson and the committee. I took, it should be in your packet, public waters is defined as 103G.005, and we cut down to subdivision 15. Under those is number 9 and 11. Number 9 says natural and altered water courses with a total drainage area of greater than 2 square miles is public waters. In your packet, there should be a map that looks something like this. Okay. The dark colored lines, there's 4 of them, are public waters. The little lines that I squiggled in are farmer ditches that farmers farm through. Those are private ditches. The reason the buffer bill has passed last May was such a firestorm is at one time the DNR wanted to have a 50-foot buffer on all the little black squiggle lines. For some people in our area, that means they would lose one-third of a quarter of land, or they'd have to farm with 4-row and 6-row equipment because you'd have all these little tiny fields. Now, the DNR, or under Governor Dayton, said we will exclude the little squiggly lines from the buffer map that's coming out in August or July. But the sword of Damocles that still hangs over our head is number 9, which says natural and altered water courses with a total drainage area of 2 square miles. If you look at the map, there are 6 square miles there. Find 2 that the DNR would not lay claim to.
Yeah, each of these squares is 1 square mile. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So that's 6 square mile. This is a township right above Johnson, Minnesota, in Traverse County.
This map is representative of 85% to 90% of the land in Traverse County and all the way up the Red River where it's flat. Some of the heavy lines that you see there, I could give you a larger map, but many of those lines are farmed through routinely year after year. That is how shallow and insignificant they are. And yet the DNR will lay claim to that. Right now, and it's not in the public waters, but we're afraid, are very concerned that someday through the back door they will again try to lay control to the farmland. And that's all the bill does is remove 9 and 11. I have a law degree. I've talked to many people. No one really can tell me what 11 means. I don't understand it. I really don't. That's, to me, if I were taking a law exam and they asked for the conclusion, I would say it's unconstitutional because it is vague and overbroad. It encompasses everything. That's why we'd like 11 removed.
Mr. Wold, I really appreciate the picture here of the map in Traverse County. But just a clarification, you said those four heavy black lines were public waters.
They are defined as public waters.
Not public ditches. They're actually public waters or rivers or creeks?
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Are there any public ditches on this map?
Not on this one. I just took a snapshot. Public ditches are defined by statute, and we have maps of those. That's not what is at issue here.
Okay. Questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm confused because I thought, I understand that the governor has removed the private ditches from the buffer consideration. Can that be clarified for me?
Mr. Walder, Representative Backer.
Mr. Johnson and Mr. Anderson, that is true. He's removed it from the map, but the statute still remains. In the future, they would still have legal access to any 2 square miles in the whole state.
Yeah, Chair Anderson and Representative Johnson, that is the concern. You are accurate that the governor said that instructed the DNR not to buffer private ditches. However, that determination on our books would allow them all those finger, what I call finger ditches, some people call them farmer ditches, could be buffered with the current law. So he said he won it, but what's going to happen in 4, 5, 6, 7 years? This would take out a third, roughly 25% to 33% of ag production land up and down the Red River Valley and other parts down by Representative Hamilton and Representative Schumacher, because that's very flat too, not as flat as we are, but that would take out a lot of potential production, and that's our concern.
And again, Representative Bly had a question.
Thank you, Chair. And my question is, I'm not disagreeing with your interpretation, what you're saying here, but are there situations where even protecting kind of in the example I was using, where you want to protect maybe a farmer from another farmer, and what I'm thinking of is that could there be situations where you might have something which an identified private ditch perhaps that a buffer would be beneficial, and even though it might take some land out of production, perhaps the farmer choosing to farm that land is not making the best choice about the land that he owns, and perhaps it ought to be protected in some way. I guess I'm just playing the devil's advocate and wondering, could there be situations where we might want to have some authority to say there ought to be a buffer there? And again, looking at how this situation can affect, I have heard from some farmers who say, my problem is the farmer upstream is affecting me. And, we put them in the situation of trying to resolve that. And I am sensitive to the fact that we want to make sure that farmers can farm and be able to use the land as they choose, but there also may be situations where there's conflict or difficulty, and I guess I'm just pressing that a little bit.
That's very subjective. Anybody care to try to tackle that answer?
Situation routinely at the Bois du Sault watershed, and the situation is not common. It comes up rather rarely, but what we have done is we encourage the farmers to work together. We have volunteered, members that's volunteered in that area, that they will mediate between situations like that. But that doesn't really relate to the bill at hand. That's kind of a different farmer to farmer. And yes, they could buffer those areas voluntarily. But what the concern of the bill is, number 9 in particular allows the DNR to have final say-so over virtually 90% of the land in Jeff's district. Control of some sort or another.
Representative Bly. Yeah. Just a quick follow-up. I get that, and I realize a lot of concern about the buffer legislation really has to do with trust, whether or not we can trust the DNR or other government entities to do the right thing or to work with the farmer in a way that you get the right solution. And so I guess my concern is that if we have no, I mean, and maybe the solution you're talking about works well in that area, I'm not so sure it works well everywhere. And maybe I'm looking for some middle ground. How do we help take care of problems that may exist, and not just, you know, leave it to a mediation which may or may not work. Again, I understand there's concern about the DNR taking more than it ought to, or taking more jurisdiction than it ought to. But it's still it's an authority that we have that might be able to help those farmers that maybe feel in a tough situation.
We're getting off topic here, but I would just comment on that, the trust factor. When farmers are accused of creating cesspools, I don't think that gets us off on a good start in terms of trusting each other in terms of doing what's best all the way around. Comment on that?
I don't disagree. Okay. I think there isn't also disagreement that there's an issue with water quality, and we need to take care of that. But I take your point and agree with you.
I think the entire state has a duty in terms of water quality, not just agriculture. We can see why this is a topic that creates some interest. Any final comments, Representative Backer? And I would agree, looking at this map, it looks to me every square foot on this six-mile section could be subject to a private public water situation.
You are correct.
Yep. Yeah. Any final comments?
Yeah, final comments, Chair and members. That's why we are beginning this discussion. We have requested a hearing in front of the Environmental Committee, but it is a big concern, and it's something that we need to look at, because we have, you know, if we look at our commodity prices, we need to do everything to support ag as much as possible, and this is, in my opinion, takes a huge step so our ag producers do not have to worry about a DNR cop coming out there and saying you can't farm this land anymore.
Thank you, Representative. Again, this was just an informational hearing. And any other comments on this bill? If not, we're going to move ahead. Thank you, Representative Backer.
Thank you.
And Mr. Wold as well. Last item up on the agenda, Representative Torkelson. And he has some folks with him. Representative has worked a great deal. In that, I put in underscore that on the buffer language and buffer bill last year, and again this year, trying to come up with some language that will work for everybody. Good morning, Representative, and welcome to the Ag Committee, and proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the invitation to be here. You know, as being one of the small number of farmers in the legislature, I miss the Ag Committee, so I'm very happy to be here and happy to present House File 3000 for an informational hearing. You know, House File 3000, at that number, it kind of sounds like a new combine, I think. Or a washing machine, I'm not sure which.
Let's hope we like it as much as the new combine.
Yeah. I'm sure most of you realize, this has been a rather controversial and piece of legislation that came about in probably a rather unconventional way at the very end of last session as a result of a number of circumstances. Over the summer, we had some disagreement on just how the legislation affected landowners and operators across the state. And this effort in House File 3000 is an effort to clarify the language and make sure that the bill does what it was intended to do. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the details. Mr. Harnack's going to come down for that. But I would just like to remind everyone that anytime we start requiring that farmers take land out of production, we are taking away from their livelihoods. A farmer has to have land to plant a crop. and make a living. And while farmers have cooperated in many ways over the years in the state of Minnesota to set land aside when it's appropriate through CRP and other programs, they are most interested in doing the right thing. They don't want to take land out of production that doesn't actually improve water quality. So we've tried to minimize this in that fashion. The other important thing to recognize is that we are working with known inventories. We have the inventory of public waters, which was determined back in the 70s through a long process of discussion and some consternation. And we're dealing with the public ditch inventory, which is also a known inventory of the ditches. The effort to include private ditches in this really was extremely problematic because there is no definition of what a private ditch is. I mean, we can look at something and each of us have an opinion on what it is, but what they really are in law has not been defined, and so it would be impossible really to move forward on that without a lot of litigation. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to, unless you want me to take some questions first, I'd be happy to turn it over to Mr. Harnack for to step through the bill.
No, just a clarification, Representative. I see we have Bill 3000, then a D1 amendment. So is this in addition to last year's legislation or totally new? And what's the amendment, the DE1?
The DE1, I thought we were dealing with the bill as it was amended in committee yesterday, which included the DE1.
Okay.
I didn't know what you had in your packets. I'm sorry.
Very good.
We'll be working off of the DE1. We incorporated that into the bill yesterday. The bill as introduced actually was some language from the Senate. The DE1 is agreed upon clarification language that we are working with both in the Senate and the House. And it was laid over yesterday in environment. We do have a few more tune-ups, one of which I should mention. We're going to add language to this bill that states that there is no intention for this bill to interfere with enrollment in CRP or other government programs now or in the future. So if you have a CRP contract or want to get a CRP contract, it is not the intent that this legislation would interfere with the right or ability to enroll in those programs. I realize I can't bind the federal government, but I can at least let them know what we're thinking.
What about when somebody's CRP contract expires? Would they be eligible to re-enroll?
It is our intention that they would be eligible to re-enroll.
Okay, thank you much. Good morning. And Representative Torkelson, thank you. And Mr. Harnack, identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Ron Harnack, representing watershed districts, primarily the ones in the Red River Valley. And we really appreciate Representative Torkelson bringing this bill forward. One of the difficulties we had with last year's bill was it provided very little certainty on a number of issues. It raised a lot of questions regarding roles and responsibilities, and we feel that it would have resulted in significant litigation. We were not able to provide some clear steps forward with the bill. It does not change the outcomes. Matter of fact, I think what it does is it will substantially improve achieving the objectives of the bill in putting buffers on the ground. I'd like to just quickly walk through each section. Just on page one, the issue of with jurisdiction, who is responsible? It was not very clear in the original bill on who was responsible. This clearly provides who is. If watershed districts assume responsibility, they have to do it by rule. They just can't do it by fiat. Counties do it by ordinances, such as for shoreland areas. Counties already have shoreland ordinances, so that's how they would administer the program. It's important to provide that. If we're going to have certainty in enforcement, we need to have certainty in the way in which the local units of government are going to assume responsibility. On the top of page two, landowners are required to put the buffers in. Under the drainage law, when you go through redetermination of benefits or through the incremental phases for putting in buffers, the ditch authority pays for those. What this ensures that when a drainage authority ultimately goes through redetermination of benefits, that the value of the land is that which existed prior to the landowner putting in buffers, so that the landowner is basically made whole. I'll give you an example. They put in the 16.5-foot buffer this year. Ditch Authority goes through redetermination of benefits in 5 years. The buffer's in place. That land's going to be valued less because that buffer is in place. It shortchanges the landowner. So this ensures that the Ditch Authority can pay that true value of that property.
Mr. Harnack, what if the ditch has not gone through redetermination at the time the buffer is installed? How do you establish that land value then?
You establish that land value based on when that buffer was put in. Okay. So if it was put in this year, it's easy to go back and look at what the market values were. Just use that framework of making that judgment. And I think that's really important because as we look at way land values are going right now, you know, there is... They are starting to slide a bit.
I have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just brought up a thought. I see what you're doing with this, and it makes good sense for me. But the value of land goes up and down. And is there a way to accommodate that? So especially if we're looking at 5-10 years down the road, it is possible we're at a peak value or a low value right now. Have you given any consideration to accommodate for that?
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think that the Drainage Authority has plenty of flexibility to address that. Further down, I know you had the discussion of public waters earlier. The public waters is a very clear document. What this does is make sure we're using the document that represents the public waters inventory that was done back in the 80s. It was not real clear at that point last year in the bill, and I think this makes it clear. Everybody's working from the same page. DNR is using this. When they put out their maps, they're putting out what was on the public waters inventory. With jurisdiction is just adding another definition that clarifies what I talked about before. On page 3, the buffer bill referred to public waters with a shoreline classification. And what this provides is clarity on what does require a buffer. And it says those areas that are contained in a locally adopted and commissioner-approved shoreline ordinance. It makes it clear. Item 2, the perennial grasses. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. We don't want to plant invasive or noxious weeds. Further down on the page, one of the practices, and in the other committee, some people were assuming that these have to be part of it. This is just kind of another set of practices that should be considered when you're looking at alternatives to a buffer. Buffers are not the end-all. You could put in other practices that could achieve far better benefit for water quality at a much lesser cost. What we should be looking at is what is the water quality outcomes we're after and put in practices that work to that benefit. On page 4, we talk about what waters get left out. If they aren't in a shoreline classification and they're not a public drainage system, there's other waters out there. Soil and water districts by July of next year are supposed to identify other waters that would benefit from having a buffer. They would make those recommendations to the local water planning authority, and they would have then, under the original bill, an obligation to update those water plans. Updating those water plans require hearings at the local level, require hearings at the state level, and then ultimately incorporation. We don't feel that it's appropriate to just do that for all 87 counties and 52 watershed districts in the state. So this suggests that they should do it at the regularly scheduled update so that we don't create an inordinate expense. we interpret this that if a watershed district or county is coming in to do some update of their plan earlier than their regular schedule, they could do that as well. Under corrective measures...
I had a question from Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, I don't remember off the top of my head, but there's actually a time frame that those water plants have to be updated. So I just want, if I don't know if you have that figure, but so people understand that this isn't something that would just lay there for 20 years and not have to be updated. If we could maybe get an answer to that.
It's 10 years, but Mr. Harnack?
Right. Mr. Chairman, you know, it's typically 5 years for local county water plans. I know all the watershed districts I work with have done that somewhere between 7 and 10 years. I don't think the watershed law says there's an absolute time frame, but with everything that's taking place out there, I don't see that that's a limitation or concern.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that five-year thing was the reference I remember, but that was specifically for the county, but
yes.
The counties, but because occasionally in one circumstance we decided to update ours a little bit early because we'd made some major changes in the shoreland requirements. Yes. But I just want to impress upon, at least from a county perspective, this would not lay undealt with for long periods of time, because if you don't update your water plan, then you lose out on some opportunities for grants and other things in the future. So there is a mechanism there to make sure that this doesn't just get forgotten.
Good point. The clock is moving, and we may go a few minutes over time if that's okay with folks who want to hear from the DNR as well and want to finish this bill overview. So go ahead, Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, under corrective actions, again, it clarifies with jurisdiction that if it's a watershed district, they've got to have rules in place, and if it's a county, they've got to have an ordinance in place. And if that county or watershed district does not choose to assume jurisdiction, then the responsibility falls to Bowser. And just one comment that I'd like to say on here, and it's kind of a personal one, is that I think to a certain extent we should not be putting the organizations that are our best helper for landowners in a position to be, what I'll use my word, of snitches, or putting the agency in a position to issue fines. You know, we've got enough of that with DNR and PCA and MDA. You know, the last vestige of agencies and local governments that help landowners, we may find that landowners won't be going to them if we put them in a bad situation. lastly, Mr. Chairman, on I guess page 5 is another one, is withholding estate money. And the way it was originally stated is it's estate money could be withheld if a local unit of government is determined to not assume this responsibility. That could mean that a county LGA could be withheld, potentially. So the clarification, I think, here is important. It's money that the Board of Water and Soil Resources has access to. I think even further clarification might be appropriate on whether or not that includes money that comes from the Clean Water Fund or some of those. That might be appropriate for some additional thought and consideration. On Section 8, this clarifies some aspects of the drainage law, and you addressed a little bit in the earlier bill. There's constraints on how much money can be used for putting these buffers in based on the amount of assessments that have historically existed on that land. And this kind of suggested that it doesn't make any difference what those historic assessments were. The Ditch Authority can assess anything just to put the buffers in. And we think that's going to raise a heck of a lot of litigation and questions, so we think it's appropriate to delete that language. The last provision was not in the original bill, but I think everybody's, Representative Torkelson, I think talking to the Senate side of this, everybody wants to see the local units of government take the lead on these. They don't want to have it to be done at the state level. But we need to create some incentives for that, because this is not a zero-cost effort. And so the suggestion here is that maybe based on the miles of public waters, miles of public drainage systems within a county, that there would be some kind of supplemental aid that could be provided that's an incentive to encourage counties and watershed districts to assume the responsibility of the buffer program. And so, Mr. Chairman, I have an obligation over in the Senate at noon at a committee meeting, and I'll answer any quick questions, but I'm sure there's other people here that can do an adequate job of that as well.
Representative Poppy, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harnack, I just have a question about that last Section 9. If there's a watershed district that or a county that's doing well and has been doing well, they don't need to be incentivized any further. Do they lose out on some funds?
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Poppy, I think this section is still a work in progress. And I know in your particular case, the county and the watershed district have, you know, done a pretty damn good job over the last 5 years of getting their buffers in place.
I had a quick question. You mentioned incentives to the counties, and one thing I've seen lacking during the whole process is incentives to the actual farmers. And we mentioned that the watershed can pay for the buffer itself. What about the case of a public waterway going through somebody's farm? 50-foot strip, compensation is a big issue there.
Mr. Chairman, it is. And one of the reasons why we've referenced public drainage systems specifically is there are a number of federal and state programs that can provide a strong rental rate or even a permanent easement on some of these public waters. None of those programs are available for public drainage systems because those federal and state programs require at least a minimum of 33 feet or maybe 30 feet now. I know I talked to a couple counties who have actually helped put additional money into SWCD's hands to help implement this. There's a darn good value in the rental rate that CRP pays right now. And when I look at land values and look at rental values, at least in my case, I'm having a tough time getting what I got last year from my renter because, you know, crop, you know, the payment rates are down, per bushel is less. And so I know in one instance, $289 cash payment under CRP continuous sign up in southwestern Minnesota. That's a pretty good price. So I think there's an incentive for those areas to put them in. Some are taking advantage of it for public dishes too, but there's not a mandate there for it.
But I would add that as you go further north, those CRP rates diminish, and dramatically diminish in some cases. When you get up to central and northern Minnesota, it's not $200 and some an acre.
Right.
Any other questions for Mr. Harnack? If not, I think we have the DNR coming up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Harnack. Welcome to the committee. Hope your lunch won't be ready right at 12 noon, but we want to hear this, at least I think most of us do. So go ahead, identify yourselves and proceed.
I'm Mr. Chairman, Director Members David Wyrens. I'm Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Tim Lesh. I'm the Minute Services Business Service Manager at the DNR.
Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know time is quite short here, so we'll try and fly through this information here and certainly be able for a follow-up conversation should members wish that at some point in time. But let me kind of run roll through this and some of the high points of the presentation with the time available.
Can you have this PowerPoint in your packets?
All right. So First, we do like to point out the reasons why we're talking about buffers are the benefits they provide in terms of filtering runoff. They provide stabilization to the banks of water courses to prevent erosion, and they provide, you know, wildlife habitat both in the area that's buffered as well as the water course itself. We also talk about in terms of the water quality benefit in that from data from the Environmental Protection Agency that the wider the buffer is, the more nitrogen that gets removed from runoff. A clear indication of why we're talking about buffers, why they're part of the conservation solution across the landscape. We also had to point out that buffers are not brand new. You heard a lot of that conversation this morning already in terms of requirements under the Shoreland Program, as well as what may in fact be the case for the Minnesota Statutes 103A, the Public Drainage Law. As you see here is a representation of how the buffering works within the shoreland area as under the DNR rule, the 50-foot buffer that's required under those existing rules. And we kind of move over to the public drainage law, where again it's one rod strip under certain circumstances.
Just have a quick question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is the most common question I get asked about the buffers. And the last slide shows the 50-foot buffer. And the question is, where does it start? How is it measured? And if that could be clarified, I think there's a lot of farmers in Minnesota who would appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, to that point, the law does define where you start to measure the buffer from. It's from the top or crown of the bank is where the measurement in fact starts from. In Representative Torgerson's bill, there is a further clarification as relates to the public drainage side of it, but it does define how to provide for that. One of our responsibilities, and if there's time we'll get to that, is really to provide clear direction on how you measure where you start that 50-foot or one rod from, because that's a clear thing that landowners need to know, programmers need to know, is kind of how do we do it, so we all have the same place to start from.
Okay, thank you.
As I mentioned, under the public drainage law, there's a requirement for the one rod strip. When viewers are appointed, again, there's been a lot of conversation this morning about that already. We did an analysis back in 2014 trying to look at the areas of the state that have an existing buffer, both public waters as well as the public ditches within the mainly agricultural counties of this state. And what our analysis determined is about two-thirds of those ditches and water courses do not have an existing buffer. Now, that does not mean anybody's out of compliance out there. What it means is current laws do not require them, is what we're saying. And this indicates what that current coverage is under existing or prior laws to what was enacted last June. As we talk about the buffer program, it's important to get into kind of what's new, what's different. It does expand the scope of waters that are covered by state laws, sets timelines for implementation, provides for enforcement, strengthens the soil erosion statute, which we won't talk much about here, a conversation in the future, and some funding was in fact provided the last session to pay for some of those costs. We talk about where buffers are in fact required. First and foremost, it's important to realize that buffers are required for watercourses shown on the DNR buffer protection maps. If a watercourse is not listed on the DNR maps, a buffer is not going to be required. That's why the mapping is such a critical part of the law, because that's going to tell landowners, local governments, where buffers are required and where it is not. But within that, what the law provides for is a 50-foot average, 30-foot minimum buffer width for public waters, and a 16.5-foot one-rod strip for the public drainage ditches. And again, these are existing widths with the existing laws. They're not brand new. The 50-foot, as we just mentioned, is currently contained in the DNR Shoreland Management Rule. The one-rod strip is currently contained within Minnesota Statutes 103, I recorded there as well. And with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Tim.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you, Dave. My name is Tim Lesh, and as I said, I'm the Minute Business Services Manager at the DNR. And my staff are in charge with taking the policy decisions and implementing them as they show up on a map that is going to aid the local units of government to implement this new requirement. We're doing this in phases. It's a pretty sizable job for us, and as Representative Torkelson indicated earlier, we are working with existing inventories. Phase one, which we did this fall, is taking the public waters inventory and starting out with that data, getting that information and maps out to our partners so that they can review that information. Phase two is what we're doing right now. We're working with the local drainage authorities to gather their public ditch information so that we can integrate it with our public waters inventory and produce the buffer map. And the next series of slides are just illustrations of how that's going. What you see on the screen now is the public waters inventory in Faribault County. You see the water courses and the wetlands and the lakes that are covered under this particular law, buffer law. The next slide, what you see in purple is the public ditch system that was provided by the drainage authority in Faribault County. We take those two pieces of information, integrate them together, and we end up with a buffer map. And this is a sample buffer map for that region. It includes two pieces of information, which features, which water bodies and waterways require buffers, and which width is required, 50 or 16 and a half feet. This is an example of what a ditch system might look like on the landscape. To the north of the road is a public water with a hypothetical 50-foot ditch, or excuse me, 50-foot buffer. On the south side of the road, in reddish purple, is a public ditch with a hypothetical 16 and a half foot buffer. This is where we're at right now. We've gathered a lot of information. We've had great cooperation with the drainage authorities. A large percentage of them have digital GIS data that we can use and incorporate into our system very effectively. We have currently received digital information from 64 of the 100 drainage authorities out there. We have recently, in fact earlier this week, published 28 drainage authorities worth of information, and those drainage authorities are currently reviewing it to make sure that we did our job right and we accurately transferred their information over to our map. So, Dave?
All right. All right. Thank you, Tim. As you move into some of the details now of how the program is going to work, as Tim alluded to, lots of work being done with the drainage authorities to get their data so we can generate the buffer protection apps and actually know where buffers are going to be required. But how the program is going to work really is going to be a partnership of work by state agencies, the rural DNR is going to have with their buffer mapping. Our work on most other elements of the program, including direction, guidance, and input from local governments and landowners. So agencies work with local governments and work with landowners. The principal local government has responsibility to other soil and water conservation districts, but there are responsibilities for counties and watershed districts in the implementation as well. One thing that Mr. Harnigan mentioned, talked about the other waters and the planning process there. There is an obligation for SPCDs to provide a summary of other water courses for the local water plant authority. They provide those by July 1 of 2017. That the law does not specify what happens to those waters. It's really going to be a local decision on if a regulatory or voluntary solution is required for those waters. The law does not specify what that in fact is. The one clarification that I'd provide to the earlier questions is that the typical plant update time frame is actually 10 years on a statewide basis, not the shorter time frame that was mentioned as part of an earlier point of conversation. There also are a series of exemptions within the law. I think from our perspective, what they really intend to do is two things. One is to avoid duplicate regulation where there are existing laws in place, and also provide for a more common sense application of it. For instance, it provides for exemptions for roads and structures. To move a road or a building doesn't seem a very reasonable application of law, and so the law provides to address some of those circumstances with those exemptions. Alternative practices are a big part of the conversation. We call it the buffer law, but it's important to recognize that landowners may comply by installing a buffer or by doing other practices that provide a comparable water quality protection. Part of our work is to better define what those practices are, how we define that comparable water quality protection angle of it. But again, there is some flexibility in the law in terms of the widths for the in terms of how wide the buffer has to be on the public waters, and what landowners have to do to come in compliance. It's not just a buffer. There are other things they, in fact, can do. And the SWCDs are required to provide assistance to landowners to help them come to compliance. And again, it was discussed as well, there are some state public programs available to help support some of the costs of complying with the law as well. And we certainly would look for more opportunities to help landowners come to compliance, really because the purpose here is to get a water quality outcome that's beneficial on a statewide basis. And we can't talk about a regulatory program without talking about enforcement. Again, a big part of some of the amendments in House File 3000 that was discussed on an earlier basis. The way enforcement, in fact, does lay out is there are responsibilities for counties, watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We have developed an approach, right, statewide assurance coverage of enforcement, and certainly we're going to be working through that with the local authorities on that.
Question from Representative Backer.
Yes, I appreciate you sharing this information, and the information that you're sharing with us is good and so forth. But one of the challenges that we have out in my district is at the hearing right now, everything sounds good. But when we get out there with the local SWCDs, I have seven of them, I have five watershed districts, DNR is nearly impossible to work with. I have two right now, a text and an email just from other people saying, very challenging with working with the DNR. You guys come here, and I appreciate that. I'm not saying anything bad about that. But you need to pass it down that the boots on the ground are very difficult to work with. And it's the number one issue that I have, and I would like you to pass that. So I do appreciate you coming here. But the DNR, out where I'm at, is not something to have cake and ice cream with. Because when they come, they're very difficult to work with.
Mr. Chair, perhaps if I respond to that perspective, at the Board of Water and Soil Resources and certainly the DNR, is to keep in mind is DNR has a very minimal role in implementing this particular law. Their job is to develop the buffer protection maps, and that really is pretty much the beginning and the end of their responsibility. Our work at the board is really to not have our staff doing much work out there, but is to provide the support and the capacity for the SWCDs and the watershed districts and the counties to be that point of contact to landowners so they know what to do and to implement the law. That is the approach that we take as an organization. Is really the best place to get this job done is not by state employees, it doesn't matter what agency, but through local governments, and we tend to really have to make that the primary point of emphasis moving forward.
Okay. Let's probably have to finish this up pretty quickly here.
Let me skip through these couple ones here. We'd like to show the good slide of farmers doing good conservation. There's a perspective out there. That's not the case. Certainly, it's not our experience as an agency. The local governments know that as well, too. But it's important to remind ourselves this, in fact, is not an anomaly across the landscape. Once those areas are buffered, they aren't prohibited from any kind of use. Landowners can graze and hay those lands as well, so there's some opportunity for an economic return. You've got to make that point known. Some of the key dates in the law, again, July 1, 16, DNR is planning to have the buffer maps are done and available. By July 1 of 17, the soil and water conservation districts have to provide the summary of other water courses we discussed. And then the compliance dates, November 1 of 17 for buffers adjacent to public waters, November 1 of 18 for the public ditches. Now, what this slide shows is the work that we're going to do. This was discussed by the Bowser Board yesterday in terms of our implementation plan. We are planning on a process of working through our board as a primary point of decision-making and direction for staff in our work. We discussed this at the meeting yesterday. We're going out with a very broad-based request for information where we want to be open to the public and for their comments and information on the implementation. We'll be coming back to our board in the month of June at their meeting with a whole series of preliminary implementation documents, board orders and policies and guidance documents, and then getting to our board in the month of August. In between times, there will be another comment period in July for people to review our draft documents, tell us what they think, what's right, what's wrong, as the case might be, so that we can incorporate that when we go to our board in August for final approval. So you can see we've organized our work into those nine boxes, a way of trying to make some sense of what's a very large task in a very short period of time. But our goal is to work through our board as the decision-making body, be open to public comment, engage as much as possible, but to get it done as quickly as possible at the same time. So with that, Mr. Chair, the last thing I'll just offer is if you and your members want more information on what's going on with our buffer work, our website is the place where that's going to be, where that is going to be showing. And be happy to answer questions here yet today if time remaining or at any other opportunity for the committee.
Thank you very much. Very excellent presentation. Anybody else in the audience who care to offer a quick comment? I'm appreciating the signs of no thanks, but a good meeting today. Representative Torkelson, any quick final comments? The path of the bill, what's ahead for it?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having this hearing. The bill is, as I said, laid over in environment right now. There's a very similar bill in the Senate that's moving through their process. It's my hope that we can all reach agreement and run this bill through as a standalone bill, but that remains to be seen. I'd like to thank all those that have been working hard on this issue. It's complicated, it's difficult, but I believe we've reached an agreement that allows enough flexibility to make sure that landowners and operators are treated fairly at the same time as we take a significant step forward in protecting the waters of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Just a couple of housekeeping comments here for committee members. Next Tuesday, 29th of March, joint Ag Policy Finance Committee hearing, a continuation of the MDA Livestock Industry Study Report. On Wednesday, March 30th, Ag Policy, and Thursday, March 31st, Ag Finance. And the GOP members, Ag Policy meeting immediately in room 300 South. And I thought Mr. Knisley had lunch, but I'm not sure.